From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Michael Lind declares the death of American conservatism. His new book, Up From Conservatism, argues that the conservative movement has been overshadowed by the radical right. Lind says that's why he went from being a neoconservative to a former conservative. Also today, Alan Toussaint, one of the key behind-the-scenes figures in New Orleans rock and roll, introduces us to one of his discoveries, singer Wallace Johnson. Johnson gave up performing about 20 years ago. Now at the age of 58, Johnson has his first album, produced by Toussaint, for Toussaint's new record label. We'll meet Toussaint and Johnson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Defense Secretary William Perry today acknowledged that military officials underestimated the terrorist threat in Saudi Arabia. 2 weeks ago, a truck bomb in Tehran killed 19 Americans. Perry testified this morning that the military was misled by intelligence reports on terrorist capability and that local commanders were slow to put in place new security procedures. Hurricane Bertha is being blamed for at least 4 deaths in the Caribbean. The storm is packing top sustained winds of 115 miles per hour as it churns closer to Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Forecasters say right now it's too early to say whether the storm will come ashore in the southeastern U.S. On the island of St. Thomas, reporter Bill Wilmer says the damage is widespread but not too severe.
We have some lines down. Some houses have been destroyed. The power is still out island-wide. We lost a lot of houses that had been first saved, sort of, by the use of tarpaulins on top of roofs and so forth. Those tarpaulins blew away, or the rain was so heavy that it just allowed all the water to come into the houses. So we haven't been able to assess how much damage that's been, but there has been some heavy damage to homes.
Reporter Bill Wilmer in St. Thomas. The Senate votes today on whether to boost the minimum wage by 90 cents an hour. Senators will also vote on a controversial Republican amendment that would prevent millions of workers from getting the increase. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Democrats believe they have the Republican support they need to pass the minimum wage increase, along with small business tax incentives. But they condemn an amendment by Missouri Republican Kit Bond, saying it would gut the increase. Companies earning under $500,000 a year would be exempt, and all employers could pay a sub-minimum training wage for the first 6 months. Democrats brought Ohio small business owner Stephen Hightower to Washington to urge Republicans not to pass the increase and then deny it to so many workers.
This is deceitful. It's shameful, and it's a betrayal to the millions and millions of Americans that have to go to work.
Republicans and business groups say the amendment is needed to limit the job losses they believe a minimum wage hike will cause. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
President Clinton is meeting this hour at the White House with the new Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. The two men are most likely discussing their different views on how to proceed with peacemaking in the Middle East. A joint news conference has been scheduled for a little more than an hour from now. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 22.90 points at 5573.73, in active trading of 159 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 5.39 points at 1154.21. This is NPR News. National Security Advisor Anthony Lake today assured Chinese officials that the U.S. has not strayed from its One China policy and will not support any independence bid by Taiwan. During a visit to Beijing, Lake urged top Chinese officials to resolve peacefully the problem with Taiwan. Negotiations were cut off a year ago. The situation in breakaway Chechnya has gotten worse. A rebel spokesman said today separatist fighters would execute Russian soldiers that had been taken hostage if Moscow carries out its threat to crack down on the region. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
The Chechen warning came as Kremlin forces launched a fierce attack against a rebel stronghold. It's the worst clash since a truce came into force last month. Both sides have accused the other of violating a preliminary accord which President Yeltsin launched in the midst of his re-election campaign. The rebels say Russian forces have stepped up shelling and bombing since Yeltsin's victory in the runoff last Wednesday. And Russian forces, which were scheduled to dismantle their checkpoints 2 days ago, have not done so. Tensions in the region worsened yesterday when General Tikhomirov, Russia's top commander in Chechnya, set a Tuesday afternoon deadline for Chechen fighters to release prisoners they hold. A Chechen rebel spokesman responded by saying separatist fighters would execute Russian soldiers they're holding if Tikhomirov carries out his threat to, quote, destroy the rebels. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
This was the hour, 12 noon Eastern Daylight Time, when the NBA free agent bonanza was to begin, when superstars such as Michael Jordan and Shaquille O'Neal would be able to sign with the team of their choice. But the free draft is off and a lockout is on. Negotiations between the NBA and the Players Union broke down this morning. The NBA announced teams are barred from signing players or making trades. The talks reportedly broke down over what to do about $50 million in profits from the NBA's television contract. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Lind begins his new book with a provocative statement: American conservatism is dead. He goes on to say that the conservative intellectual movement was the first element of mainstream conservatism to fail. He blames its demise on the rise of the far right. In fact, the rise of the far right is one of the reasons Lind no longer considers himself a conservative. Lind describes himself as having gone from the right wing of liberalism to the left wing of conservatism and back. He was a researcher for his mentor, William F. Buckley. In his 20s, he served in the Bush administration's State Department. Lind edited the neoconservative foreign policy journal, The National Interest, served as senior editor at Harper's and The New Republic, and is now a staff writer at The New Yorker. In his new book, Up From Conservatism, Lind says that the Republican Party is now made up of two incompatible groups, populists and business elites.
Well, they're incompatible inasmuch as in the American populist tradition, one of the chief targets traditionally has been Wall Street. It's been the rich. There's this kind of crude anti-capitalism of the right, which you see manifested in some of the comments of Patrick Buchanan, which is just as deep. It's probably deeper in American political culture than any sort of anti-capitalism of the liberalism or of the left. Now, what conservatives have managed to do in recent decades is to divert the traditional animus of American populists against Wall Street against other targets, like big government, bureaucrats, public school teachers, minorities, homosexuals, and so on. And I'm convinced, on the basis of observation as well as just of reading and analysis, that this is more or less conscious strategy to find scapegoats, while at the same time cultivating this populist anger. Now, the problem is this is not going to work in the long run, and the Patrick Buchanan phenomenon is very significant.
How?
Because for the first time, really since George Wallace, you have a genuine, old-fashioned, demagogic, primitive populist on the American political scene. That is, what conservatives from Nixon all the way up until Reagan and Dole have tried to do, in Bush, is to say, well, we're populist when it comes to Hollywood, you know, the arts, public schools, and so on. On the other hand, we reject the populist critique of inherited wealth and of Wall Street. Now, Buchanan has managed to wed these two things. That is, he's a conventional populist in every respect. He's anti-Wall Street and anti-immigrant and anti-homosexual. This is a very powerful combination. It's something that panics the Republican elite and the conservative establishment, because it kind of destroys their whole game of being pseudo-populists.
You think the purpose of the culture wars is to divert the anger of populist voters away from Wall Street and corporate America to other targets like the media, racial minorities, homosexuals, immigrants? Where do you see Dole fitting into the whole culture war scenario?
Well, Dole is trying to have it both ways. And it really depends on the timing of his campaign. That is, I think Dole is an extraordinarily cynical individual. I don't think if he has any convictions, no one's ever been able to discover what they really are. During the primary phase of his campaign, he moved to the right in order to and emphasized all these culture war themes in order to get the support of the Protestant fundamentalists, who are now the grassroots base of the Republican Party. He realized, and of course realized before he even ran, that during the general election, he has to move to the center. Now, he's been very inept because sometimes he's moved both directions at once within the same week. You know, in the flaps over getting a contribution from gay Republicans, in his present floundering around over abortion. But you can kind of forgive him for that because what's happening is the center and the far right are drifting ever further apart. And the kinds of mainstream Republicans who try to veer to the right to get nominated and then have to veer to the center to get elected, the pendulum swings are becoming more and more pronounced. And so you have to have a certain amount of sympathy for Dolan politicians like him.
Michael Lind is my guest. His new book is called Up From Conservatism. You describe Pat Robertson as being the single most important kingmaker in the Republican Party. I wonder if you still think that's true. I mean, Pat Robertson, for instance, didn't make Bob Dole, and Bob Dole is the, is probably the nominee for the Republican Party for president.
If Pat Robertson had come out and opposed Bob Dole, and if Bob Dole had not appeased the Christian Coalition on all of the issues it considers important, then Bob Dole probably would not be the president now, or the presidential candidate of the Republican Party. If you look at what's going on now, the supposed great debate within the Republicans over abortion, it's not even considered that the Republican Party will change its position on abortion. This entire debate, instead of being over whether to continue with this ridiculous pretense, which the vast majority of Americans, or rather the vast majority of Republicans oppose, namely the idea that abortion is murder. Most Republicans reject this idea. This is held only by a tiny minority, mostly of Protestant fundamentalists and right-wing Catholics. Nevertheless, it's not even considered that this will be changed in the Republican platform. The entire debate is over whether a declaration of tolerance for other views, i.e. the views of the vast majority of Republican voters and secretly politicians, will be placed within the abortion plank or in the preamble of the Republican Party platform. Now, to me, that the fact that you're having that kind of very minor, trivial debate while giving the Christian Coalition everything it wants in terms of substance proves the continuing power and relevance of Pat Robertson and the religious right.
But Bob Dole seems willing to entertain the idea of a running mate who is pro-choice.
Well, that's right. That's part of his strategy of moving towards the center in the general election.
But that's hardly appeasing Pat Robertson.
It's appeasing him on the platform. If you have a pro-choice running mate, but the platform says that abortion is murder and women who get abortions, are murderers of their children, this is the official position of the Republican Party. And the pro-choice candidate, the vice president, is not going to do anything about it one way or the other. So I think it is appeasement.
Pat Robertson was the creator of the Christian Coalition, but the head of the Christian Coalition is Ralph Reed. And Ralph Reed.
Well, that's not entirely correct. He's the executive director. Pat Robertson is still the president.
Thank you. And Ralph Reed espouses a much more, as he would describe, an inclusive point of view. He's talked about being very dedicated to including African Americans and even Jewish conservatives within the coalition. Who do you see as really having the power now, and which set of views do you see as being truly representative of the Christian Coalition, Pat Robertson's or Ralph Reed's?
It's Pat Robertson's. Reed has been promoted as a front man, but the real power remains in the hands of Pat Robertson, of his allies on the board of the Christian Coalition. At the end of the day, Reed is just an employee. He said recently on Charlie Rose that on no single issue does he disagree about anything with Pat Robertson. And so that comes from Ralph Reed himself.
While you were in the Republican Party and while you
count... I was never in the Republican Party. I was a Reagan Democrat, along with a great number of neoconservative Democrats who tended to vote Republican in national elections while retaining their Democratic affiliation in state and local politics.
Well, while you counted yourself a conservative intellectual, how did you think other conservative intellectuals were responding to the increasing power of Pat Robertson and other Christian fundamentalists within the party?
Well, it really astonished me. If you look back to the late 80s, Jerry Falwell was dissolving the Christian the moral majority. There had been a number of sexual and financial scandals involving televangelists. So it appeared that the religious right was in retreat, and more moderate centrist mainstream conservatives and neoconservatives were in the ascendancy. All of this was reversed, much to my astonishment, in 1992, when I expected that after Buchanan's horrific speech at the Houston Convention, and the increasing radicalism of Robertson, the religious right, that there would be some sort of concerted effort by neoconservatives and mainstream conservatives to team up with moderate Republicans against the far right. And it turns out that I had been too enclosed in the little cocoon of Beltway politics and of intellectual conservatism in general. What had happened, beginning in the late 80s, kind of below the radar, was that the fundamentalists had infiltrated the Republican Party at the local level, the local and state level, precinct by precinct. They had waged war within the Republican Party against what they called the left. By the left, they meant Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, Republicans. That shows you how far right they are. And so the extreme far right, by the time anybody woke up and realized what had happened, controlled the grassroots mechanism, the nominating mechanism of the Republican Party. And this was all by 1992. In retrospect, Pat Robertson's 1988 presidential race was not a miserable failure. He didn't get many votes in the nomination to be the GOP presidential candidate. But what he did was he created the most effective grassroots machine that now exists within the Republican Party. He turned his mailing list from his 1988 presidential campaign into what became the Christian Coalition.
You wrote what turned into a pretty influential piece on Pat Robertson in the New York Review of Books. And your piece was about the conspiracy theories that he espoused in his book, The New World Order, and about the coded language of anti-Semitism that he used in that book. What made you decide to investigate that and write that piece on Robertson?
Well, actually, I got interested in this a few years before when I still considered myself a conservative, when Robertson had not revealed himself as the power in the Republican Party that he was. I just thought he was another kooky TV preacher. This was back around 1991, 92. And I was working at the State Department at the time under the Bush administration. And I found this book in a Virginia bookstore. And, you know, it says, Pat Robertson reveals the truth about the Gulf War. Well, since I'd been a consultant to the State Department during the Gulf War, I was kind of interested in actually what the truth was, according to Pat Robertson. So I started reading it. And much to my horror, I discovered this classic right-wing paranoid conspiracy theory, which is not only anti-Semitic, but it's anti-Masonic. You know, it's obsessed with the Freemasons and the Jews and the international bankers. And all of the usual bogeys of the far right, which I recognized from my own training in graduate school from European diplomatic history. I mean, this was the basis of the Nazi view of the world, of the fascist, of the French royalist right in the 19th century. This whole kind of melange of conspiracy theories, and they all tend to stick together. That is, the anti-Jewish conspiracy theory tends to be wedded to the anti-Mason theory. And here it was being recycled by this TV preacher. And I didn't think that much about it when I thought that Robertson was on his way out, like Jerry Falwell and these guys. And I returned to it when, after 1992, he emerged as the most powerful grassroots leader in the Republican Party.
Give us an example of one of the conspiracy theories that you read about in his book.
Well, for example, in The New World Order, he says it is his belief, although he can't prove it, that President Andrew Jackson was assassinated at the behest of the European bankers. Because he destroyed the Second Bank of the United States, which we were to believe was part of this evil. Like most of these right-wing crackpots, Robertson is obsessed with banks, you know, and usury and money lending, which lends itself, of course, to anti-Semitic theories of all sorts. Now, by the European bankers, he's kind of vague as to whom he means, but it's clear that the only, in the rest of the book, that he's talking about the Rothschilds, the great Jewish bankers of 19th and early 20th century Europe, who are the classic bogeys, the classic demons in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, including those of Adolf Hitler and of 20th century fascists.
So what was Pat Robertson's views about the truth of the Gulf War?
Well, he suggests that it might have been a setup, that's his words, a setup by powerful forces trying to increase the power of the United Nations by deliberately stirring up a crisis. Now, of course, he always phrases this in the form of questions. You know, could it be? Is it possible that? So that when you call him on it, you know, he can say, well, he's just raising the question. But, you know, I've read a great deal of diplomatic discussions of the Gulf War, and Robertson's is the only one in which anyone suggested that this was some kind of scheme by internationalist bankers and sinister, you know, UN supporters to provoke Saddam Hussein into attacking the U.S. and therefore increasing the power of the United Nations.
What would you say the impact of your piece on Robertson's conspiracy theories was?
Well, it was devastating to judge from the fact that Robertson has essentially disappeared from public life following the publication of my piece in the spring of 1994 in the New York Review of Books. And it was at that time, following the publication of my piece, where he really vanished, and they began pushing Ralph Reed as the front man. Because after that, Robertson was just too discredited. And he's essentially hid at Virginia Beach at his headquarters ever since, making very few public appearances.
Michael Lind is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Up From Conservatism. He describes himself as being a former neoconservative who went to becoming, an ex-conservative?
Right.
Okay. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Lind, author of the new book, Up From Conservatism, Why the Right is Wrong for America. What was your first political alignment? You're a former neoconservative, is the way you describe yourself. Where were you, say, when you were in college politically?
Well, in college I worked in the Texas Senate. I was in, I guess I would be considered a moderate liberal Democrat in Texas, which means somewhat conservative by national standards. The tradition I identified with, partly through family connections, was that of Barbara Jordan and of Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey. And within the Democratic Party, that faction had been losing out in the late 60s and throughout the 1970s to what Newt Gingrich has called, not entirely inaccurately, is the countercultural McGovernicks, that is, the new left and the supporters of George McGovern and the opponents of Hubert Humphrey.
Did you feel that compared to the other students on the Yale campus, you were really conservative by comparison, even though you still thought of yourself as a democratic liberal?
Yes. Yes. And partly this is a regional cultural difference. That is, being a liberal in Texas tends to be translate into being a conservative in New Haven. And the ADA has done lists over the past couple of decades, you know, of who's a 100% liberal, who's 100% conservative. In most cases, the perfect liberals tend to be from the Northeast and the Midwest, and the perfect conservatives tend to be from the South and the West. Now, to me, this raises the question of whether what we call liberalism and conservatism is really that. That is this really the left and the right, strictly defined in terms of attitudes towards the state and government, or have a lot of cultural folkway issues gotten wrapped up into American politics? So that, in other words, I've always had the suspicion that a lot of what is considered left and right in America is really north and south, mm-hmm. or east and west.
Let me get your quick take on the Democratic Party.
Well, the Democrats, I think, for the past 20, 30 years, Democratic leaders have tried to disguise the fact that the Democratic Party today is primarily a northern liberal party. It's a party of the Northeast and of the Midwest and of the Pacific Coast. And they have to get these right-wing Southerners like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton in order to get Southern votes. Now, I think if they're smart, what they'll do is just write off the South, see that the conversion of the South to the Republican Party, in the White South, I mean, is an enormous boon for them. The Republicans are going to be dragged down if they're identified, you know, primarily with Southern Baptists and Pentecostalists. And at the same time, there are real liberals in the South. You know, you have the entire black Southern population. You have growing numbers of urban and suburban whites throughout the South and the Southwest. So I think if the Democrats were smart, they would reorganize themselves as a consistently nationalistic, by which I mean, you know, supporting the federal government, socially liberal and economically liberal party, and just abandon any attempt to appease any kind of Southern conservative wing. Now, unfortunately, Clinton seems to be stuck in this old mindset where you have to try to get as many Southern conservative votes as possible by disguising how liberal the Democrats really are.
What are you expecting this year from the Republican convention?
Well, I expect they'll try to make it as short and sweet as possible. You know, they don't want to repeat the disaster that they had last time where Patrick Buchanan's inflammatory speech dominated the convention and scared off lots of moderates from the Republican Party. You know, the conventions themselves really no longer serve any purpose, given the fact that In the old days, the presidential candidates were actually chosen at the conventions by power brokers. Now it's just kind of a pro forma ceremony. And it seems to me if they were smart, they would actually cut it down in size. You know, you just have, you know, a day or an hour. And the longer it goes on, the more of a risk there is that their clever attempt to package the Republican Party to disguise the true kookiness of some of their constituents will backfire.
Now, I want to get back to another criticism that you make in your new book. You say that you see a revival of racism on the right. What are the manifestations of that revival, the way you see it?
Well, the right's always been racist in the United States. I mean, you know, the conservatives in the 50s and 60s were the defenders of segregation, and they claimed it was because they were in favor of states' rights. But if you actually go back and look, you know, they weren't saying we want statewide civil rights acts instead of federal civil rights acts. So this was just an excuse to oppose any civil rights act. What happened from the late 60s up until the early 90s was that mainstream conservatives, and then with the influx of neoconservative Democrats, the neoconservatives, essentially the line was that the right had been completely mistaken about civil rights. They just accepted that this was all a disaster, that Martin Luther King and Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights integrationists had been correct. And so the line was that we support integrationist approach to civil rights, and we simply oppose racial quotas and the more left liberal approach. Now, a few years ago, that began to change. With the success of Charles Murray in the bell curve, actually reviving all of these long discredited arguments about eugenics, about the supposed genetic inferiority of black Americans to white Americans. And then most recently, Dinesh D'Souza, in his book, The End of Racism, Dinesh D'Souza of the American Enterprise Institute proposed repealing the Civil Rights Act. He said it was a mistake to have government laws against private racial discrimination. If an employer said, I don't like you because you're black or Jewish or female or whatever, and I hate blacks or women or Jews, he could fire you. You'd have no legal recourse. This is what Dinesh D'Souza was proposing. And it's inconceivable that any mainstream conservative would have said that in the 1980s. This shows you how far to the right the whole conversation has drifted.
Where do you feel most at home now politically? Is there any group that you identify yourself with?
Yes, the Democrats that I tend to identify with the most are the pro-liberal Democrats, like David Bonnier, for example, and the people trying to revitalize the labor movement. I think liberalism took a wrong turn in the 1960s when it abandoned its historic connection with a cross-racial working-class labor coalition and got involved in the quagmire of identity politics. So before long, you have multiplying groups of based on race and ethnicity and gender. And I think those Democrats trying to go back to the old pro-labor activist government tradition are the ones that I identify with the most.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Michael Lind's new book is called Up From Conservatism. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, New Orleans music legend Alan Toussaint introduces us to soul and blues singer Wallace Johnson. Johnson gave up performing 20 years ago. Now at the age of 58, he has his first album produced by Toussaint for his new record label. We'll meet them both. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Toussaint is one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the development of New Orleans rock and roll. He got his start playing Fats Domino piano parts on Domino's own records when the Fat Man was on the road. In the early 60s, Toussaint produced, wrote, and arranged hits by Ernie K. Doe, Irma Thomas, Aaron Neville, and Benny Spellman. Toussaint's songs include Mother-in-Law, Working in a Coal Mine, and Lipstick Traces. More recently, he's worked with the Pointer Sisters, Bonnie Raitt, the Judds, and Elvis Costello. Now he's showcasing talented but virtually unknown New Orleans performers on his new label. It's called NINO, an acronym for the two cities that are home to his recording studios, New York and New Orleans. We'll meet one of his discoveries in a couple of minutes. Before we hear from Toussaint himself, let's hear some music from Toussaint's own new record. It's called Connected.
Every time the telephone rings, I hold my breath, hoping that it's you I'm scared to death. The phone went ring, my crippled heart cried, let it be you on the line. Then a voice said, hello, may I speak to Joe? Wrong number, I'm sorry, goodbye.
Alan Toussaint, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me why you wanted to start a new record label.
Well, actually, it was Josh Feigenbaum's brainchild. And he thought it would be a great idea to do the indigenous music of New Orleans and present it in the best light we possibly could, really make a grand effort on doing it right. And we talked about it for the last 3 or 4 years.
How are you deciding who you want to showcase on your new label?
Well, sincere hearts, people that really have a zeal for the music that they're doing and try and stay true to form and not trying to emulate and imitate the world outside.
Now, you're still writing a lot of songs, and you wrote most of the songs on the new Wallace Johnson record, which we'll be hearing from in a moment. You wrote the songs on your new CD. How do you decide which songs you're going to sing yourself and which you're going to give to other people?
Well, the songs that I write, let's take Wallace, for example. The songs that I did write for Wallace was written because of the way he sounds and the things that he would feel comfortable saying. It's like tailoring a suit for him. In fact, many times he was right there, and his mere existence is just like being a co-writer of it. It's because of the way he is, the things he would bring across better. By getting to know him, I get to feel those kinds of things. So I write directly for him. If it wasn't for him, those songs would never have been written. It's not like I could have written them for someone else and just handed them over to him. It wasn't like that at all.
Now tell me what you like about Wallace Johnson's singing.
The sincerity, mostly. And the voice is clear. I like that. And the zeal for what he's doing. You can hear the zeal in his heart when he's singing. That this is what he really want to be. Every part of him is there at the moment. He's not divided. And he's not divided in the type of music he wants to do. It's not like he really wants to do gospel, but he's doing this for today. And that comes across.
Now, I want to play the first track from the new Wallace Johnson CD. It's This Night Belongs to You. This is one of This is one of your songs. Would you tell us about writing this for him?
That's a setup hearing Wallace's voice, the way Wallace sounds. It seemed like he could really say this very well. And Wallace is a person who is a romanticist also. And that's how that came about. And it's up in a melodic range that I thought was very good for Wallace. It has its normality for a while, and where it peaks is right a great place to highlight a certain lift in his voice that I thought would be good, and it did work.
Well, let's hear it. And Alan Toussaint, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your new label.
My pleasure. Thank you.
this night belong to you, baby. Tomorrow belong to tomorrow. You can have anything you want. This is your night tonight. This night belongs to you. This night belongs to you. We can go any place you wanna go, do anything you wanna do. I appreciate you, baby, though many times it doesn't show. It may look like I take you for granted, but that just ain't so. I get so caught up in the rush and don't take the time to let you know how I feel about you.
That's Wallace Johnson from his first album, Whoever's Thrilling You, produced by Alan Toussaint for Toussaint's new record label, Nino. We'll talk with Johnson after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you like Wallace Johnson singing as much as we do, you must be wondering why you've never heard of him before, so we invited him to tell us about himself. He grew up in rural Louisiana, made a couple of 45s in the early 60s, recorded with Alan Toussaint in the early 70s, ran a club for a while, and then quit music altogether for a more reliable living as a longshoreman. He hasn't quit his day job yet. He now works as a project manager for a janitorial company in Louisiana. I asked Wallace Johnson how it feels to have his first album at the age of 58.
It feels good. It feels real good. But I'll tell you something about that. Just last week, somebody mentioned that. And I stopped and I really thought about it. And up until somebody mentioned it, you know, I know this is my first album. I know I'm 58 years old. But I never really stopped and said, oh, I'm 58 and now... And I really looked at that, and it feels good. Made me feel better once I really stopped and looked at it.
Did it make you feel older or younger to think of it that way?
Just better.
Well, good enough. Now, what kind of work have you been doing over the last few years?
Okay, I'll go back. The last time I was in the studio was in 1972. Did a tune with Alan. And since then, I worked as a longshoreman. I was injured in that job in 1974. I opened a club and operated that for a couple of years. After that, I drove a taxi cab, and for the last 15 years, I've worked as a project manager for a janitorial company.
So back in the early 70s, when you were singing, what kind of material were you doing?
R&B. Just trying to, just singing, not really pinpointing anything, just singing.
What kinds of songs? Name some of the songs you were doing then.
Oh, Baby Go Ahead, I'm Grown, I Miss You Girl.
These are not songs that are familiar to me. Would you sing a few bars of one of them?
I miss you, girl. Ooh, baby, I miss you, girl. Ooh, baby, don't you know I miss you, girl? I miss the way you hold my hand. I miss the way you understand. I know sometimes I've been wrong, but things haven't been the same since you've been gone. And it went on like that.
That sounds good. Did you write that?
I wrote that one, yes.
Oh, that sounds real good. So did you recorded back in the early 70s?
Yes, at that I recorded that. That was the last song I recorded, and Alan did that on me. The tunes that I called, Alan recorded those.
Oh, so and did they get airplay in New Orleans?
A little.
Was it a great disappointment for you that they didn't catch on? What were you hoping?
It was a big disappointment. Every time I went in and did a 45. You know, you're just hoping. You're hoping that this is the one that give you a chance to do what you really want to do for whatever reason you want to do that. And I just love doing that, always have.
And when did you start singing?
As far back as I can remember.
And when did you start performing?
I was in the Army, and it was 1955, a guy walked up to me, mistook me for somebody else. And I knew who he was talking about. This guy sang with a group. I said, no. I said, my name is not Ray. My name is Wallace. So he said, well, can't you sing? I said, no. He said, man, anybody can sing. I never will forget him, a little guy named Wilcox from Savannah, Georgia. And we formed a group, and I became the lead singer of the group. And we were singing stuff like Sincerely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're doing like harmonies.
Yeah. And I was always a shy kind of person. I really wanted to sing background because I liked that harmony kind of thing. And at the time, I thought I had a nice little tenor voice, you know.
Hmm. So you did that in the Army.
And, yeah.
And then when you got out, did you perform?
No, but when I got out, I started searching. And then I was going to music school at Houston's down on Claiborne, and I met Harold Betties, who was working for Specialty Records at the time. And
the musician.
I met Harold. And Harold told me that they were about to start this new label. And would I be interested in being with this new label, AFO? I said, well, yeah. So that's when I really did my first session. And the very first time I went in the studio, that's the very first time I met Alan. He walked in the studio that night.
What was the song you sang?
The very first thing I did was a song called Clap Your Hands. True Love Was Never Meant For Me.
Can you do a bit of it?
True Love Was Never Meant For Me?
But either one.
So many days I've sit and cried. You've gone and left me. I wonder why. I need you, darling, to give me peace of mind. The name of that one was Peace of Mind. I gave you the wrong title from the beginning.
Oh, okay.
Long time ago.
So that's the first side you recorded?
Very first song.
And did anything happen with the records?
No.
So what did you do? Did you keep trying to sing anyways?
When I did that, I was living in Napoleonville. That's the town of my birth. And at the time I was married and I had a family. And it was really a hardship to run back and forth 70 miles from the country, as we called it, to the city. And it was no venues for me to play out there, so it just lived inside of me, that's all.
Now, did you feel cheated and feel resentful all the years when you were driving a taxi or working as a longshoreman or doing janitorial work instead of being on stage?
Yes, I've had those kind of feelings, but I never let that stay with me. I never let that stay with me because the folk that we see now and we call quote unquote stars, everybody have their good times and their bad times. I never let that kind of, if I let that stay with me, I wouldn't be here now. Because I never would have followed up, if I felt like that, I never would have let the music live with me. Things would have been different. It just would have been different. No. I always felt like this is what I want to do, and one of these days I'll get a chance to do this, and I'll just do it as good as I can do it.
Now, did you work with Alan Toussaint on choosing which songs would be on the new record?
Oh, yeah, we did that every time we got together and talked about a song. Yes, indeed. He wanted to make sure that I felt comfortable with it. Yes, indeed.
One of my favorites on the CD is actually a Brooke Benton song called I'll Take Care of You.
Really?
Yeah. You don't like it? You sound skeptical.
No. My daughter, one of my daughters, she told me, she said, Daddy, all the songs, she said, that's the one. I love that song. As a matter of fact, I asked them to let me do that, and I like that song. But I like all of them, really. Just when you said that, it just popped in my mind like that.
So your daughter likes it a lot, too?
Yeah, she liked that. She really liked that.
So why did you decide to put that on the new record?
Well, we talked about covers, and actually I thought about doing a couple covers, and we got it down I'll just do one cover, and that was the song that I chose. I had a few other songs in my mind, but that was the song. I like what that song says.
What do you like about what the song says?
You know, all songs tell a story. All songs tell a story. And everybody have their insecurities. Everybody needs to be needed, needs to be wanted. That song says that. That song assures a person that you'll be there for them.
Well, why don't we hear I'll Take Care of You, the Brooke Benton song that you've recorded on your new CD, Whoever's Thrilling You.
Okay.
And this is Wallace Johnson.
You won't ever have to worry. You won't ever have to cry. I'll be right there beside you. True, for there is no doubt in my mind. I know what you want me to do, and just as sure as one and one is two, I'll take care of you. You know I will.
Now, who did you listen to when you were growing up?
Everybody. In the mornings, when I woke up, the first thing on the radio you heard was, they called it hillbilly, you know? What they call country and western today.
Mm-hmm.
And after hillbilly, the next thing came, when the black radio station came on, you heard gospel for about a couple hours. After gospel, you heard the blues.
Where you were growing up, did you get to hear live music at all, or was it all on the radio and on record?
It was all on radio. Radio, mm-hmm. Records.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very little live. The first person I saw was a blues singer, Roy Brown. And I think I was about 14 mm-hmm. when I saw him. I got to the stage and never moved, stayed right there.
My guest is Wallace Johnson. He has a new CD called Whoever's Thrilling You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wallace Johnson. At the age of 58, he's recorded his first album for Alan Toussaint's new record label, Nino, showcasing performers from New Orleans and thereabouts. Now, how did Alan Toussaint ask you to record a record for his new company?
I met some guys. I met this one guy, Alonzo, the bass player. And this was 3 years ago now. We were out in the French Quarter at the French Quarter Festival. And we stopped in this little club, the Crazy Corner. And I got on stage and sang. And believe it or not, this was the first time I ever sang on a stage in a club in New Orleans in my life. And I had sung in church, but never on a stage here.
And what year was this?
3 years ago.
Wow.
And being with Lonzo plays Zydeco. But if I'm out, my girl loves to dance, and she loves Zydeco. So if we're out, Lonzo talked to the band leader, and he asked me to come up and do a blues. So I started doing that. And then I met a disc jockey who worked at the public radio station here, WWLZ, and he had a little blues band, and he'd invite me out to go with him. So I started doing that, and I enjoyed it. And I told Alan what we were doing, and he said, well, that's good. You know, and really it was just good for me to get out and do that. And then I decided I'd do a demo. And I told Alan about it. He said, well, good. He said, you know, you get everything together, and we'll see how that goes. And we started with the demo, and Alan said folk had heard the three tunes we did, and they liked them. And he asked me, how would I like to sign with Nino? He told me about Nino and how would I like to sign. Well, I didn't even have to think about that. I said yes, and that's how it happened.
Now, did you recently perform at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival?
Yes, I did, May 2nd.
So since your first time on stage was just 3 years ago, what was it like to perform at the festival?
Felt real good. Felt real good. I mean, it just when I got the invitation, I never forget. I ran upstairs and I just sat on the bed and I looked at it and I was really overwhelmed as many times as I stood out there and watched folk, you know. But when the time came, I was a little nervous, but it really felt good and it went good. And what really made it go good, the guys that these guys that did the session with me, especially the rhythm guys, they're more than just musicians to me. You know, they help keep me together.
Mm-hmm. I want you to choose one of your favorites from your new CD.
Song?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Your Man.
Okay. Why don't we close with that? And tell us why you chose it.
I chose I'm Your Man because it says exactly what I would say. And there's a little story when I'm your man. Can I tell that?
Please.
I was at Alan's house. We were playing pool. It was three of us, me, Alan, and another keyboard player, Marcel. And we were in the middle of a pool game. Alan was playing. And he stopped, and he walked in the back for about maybe 10 minutes. And he came back, and he got on the table, and he shot about two shots. They stopped again. And he's gone for about another 10 minutes, and he came back, and he watched us play. So when Marcel and I finished the game, he said, why don't we walk in the back and try this on, you know, try something. And I'm Your Man was born.
I mean, he wrote that while you were playing pool together.
Yep.
And he wrote it for you?
Yep.
For this new record?
Yes, he did.
Well, that's a nice story. Why don't we hear it? Wallace Johnson, good luck to you. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Wallace Johnson's new CD is called Whoever's Thrilling You. It's recorded on Alan Toussaint's new label, Nino. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Louisa Shafia, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Yourself a pet.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of ID, How Heredity and Experience Make You Who You Are by Winifred Gallagher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.